Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Business news, views, and insights from across the globe.
Welcome, everyone, to a new chapter of Hidden Growth Champions, our podcast series. Today in our studio, we've got Ankit Khandelwal. Ankit, it's great to have you in our studio. Welcome. You know, this is one of our featured episodes, diving into the education sector and the disruption that's taking place in it. It's great to have you in our studio, and I'm looking forward to our conversation. Please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Good morning, Sar. Hello, everybody. My name is Ankit Khandelwal, and I'm entrepreneur, innovator based out of India. And for many years, I'm helping startups, middle-scale companies, and individuals in their various business needs. I act as like a coach, guide, mentor, consultant, even as fundraiser. And I always like to find the innovative solutions. How can you make something better? It's not that I'm always successful in implementing those ideas, but that's how I think. That's how I like to help people. How can we make a process better? How can we improve something to get better? And I have worked with many people across the world, in India, across the countries, in different sectors, though primarily in educational and agriculture sector, or most edtech. That's what we call these days.
That's fantastic. I'm sure we'll delve a lot into that. And Keith, maybe take us a little bit backwards. You've become rather famous for an experiment you've run and a product you've developed called the Zero Cost MBA. And I remember the first time I came across your name, and we've had a conversation since, that concept is really kind of clicked. It certainly piqued my attention. It certainly is an unusual name for it. People are not used to not paying for an MBA. In fact, it's one of the most costly degrees out there. And you've gone about innovating something, and with a twist, with a surprise. But I know there's much more to it than just the cost element. So maybe take us a little bit back into that time in your life where you had to innovate education around that particular degree.
I didn't know it's so catchy. I just had to give some name to summarize it. And somehow this zero cost name came when I was eating in a coffee shop, in a restaurant, and there was a tag. There was a tag is more about, if you waste food, you have to pay for it. You have to pay for it. And somehow I backed it. Okay, if I don't do something, or if I am doing something without paying, okay, it could be zero cost. So that's where zero cost MBA came. Telling about how it came into, how I thought of doing it. Well, when I was thinking about moving ahead my career, I realized I'm very good in strategic planning, people, and understanding the market trends. And I did not have any formal education till that time. I had family business. My grandfather used to run a pharmaceutical shop, and I spent a huge amount of time in my summer vacations to understand nuance of interpersonal relationship, how to make deals. But still, I did not have any formal education. And if you want to go beyond a single shop, or you want to advise somebody, you have to learn those nomenclatures, those words, to communicate beyond your immediate vicinity. And that's why, okay, I have to do some sort of managerial education. That's what I thought. However, there are two problems. First, the management education is too expensive. You rightly said it's very costly, and it's too long. It's 2 years. You have to spend 2 years. And the third thing is, you have to wait for next year to start. For a person like me, who have already gone to 2 degrees, I think I forgot to tell my educational background, but I have a master's in chemical engineering and bachelor's too, from 2 top universities across the world. And that's a bit of a story why I chose to manage inside, but maybe some other time. But I already had 2 degrees with me from 2 universities. So I have quite proven myself that, yes, I'm a, well, if society standards, by any standards, yes, I'm an individual, smart, educated, or talented person. I don't have to go back to university again to prove it, okay, I'm a so-so guy. So that's where the search started. How can I do it? the way I want to do it. And the fourth thing, the problems I've seen in many of the management curriculums is they are very much theoretical and they still teach the same concept over and over again, which is fine. But it just, I don't see how they are practical. How do I apply them in practice? And this was a time when I returned from Denmark, where there was so much emphasis on learning by doing. Whatever you study, you should be able to apply in practice. That's how you can make learning joyful. If we read, apply it, then it will stick to our brain for a longer time. So this all concept came into play and I started researching. How can I do it? How can I do it? And I researched some management curriculum of top universities. I studied some of the courses and some of the courses are, how do I say, they are very much, you don't have to study. Like this can be controversial, I agree that there is a concept of how to be happy. So there was a course, how to be happy. And I said, why do you have to study this course? It's a one semester course. It's just, I'm sure there must be a reason behind it, but I don't need it. There's a quote of how to talk to people, how to develop your communication skills. And I always thought I'm not bad at it at all. So I don't need to study that course either. So there has been so many courses I felt I don't have to study. I already have those. And if I keep practicing talking to people or applying in situations, my professional person, I will develop more. So these classroom courses, which I find redundant or not useful to me, are not needed. And I added more areas which I feel future is going to be or I need. Let's say international trade. I added this course. It wasn't taught at the time in management school. It's extra if you want to study. And public policy, that's something not taught. It should be taught because businesses are closely linked with how government formulate policies. That has to, we have to know in which direction government is thinking. Otherwise, we end up completely alienating ourselves. And intercultural communication, that's something I haven't found anywhere at that time. Maybe now it's there. And it's very important if you want to be internationalized. I have faced many difficulties when I was studying in Denmark of communicating with people at the start. And I'm sure businesses too face issues in making transition in people-to-people conversation. So these sort of many courses I've added of future trends. There was one trend about climate change. The climate change of that time was still a debatable topic, but what does it mean for corporation? That wasn't there. So still we have so many people talking, but what does it mean to people? What does it mean to small businesses? What does it mean to individual and how to quantify it? That wasn't there. So I added this course on understanding to understand how to quantify climate change, how it's going to affect an individual's business, and how, as a businessman or as a consultant, I could be someone who can advise him how to go further. And those were the things I designed a sort of a sample curriculum of myself, just to keep myself, okay, these are the things I know, these are future trends, and this is the thing I have to study or I have to develop it myself to become some sort of manager I want to become, a global manager. That was my vision. And I want to be a global manager who has ability to understand the market trends, who has ability to apply interdisciplinary approaches, and who can work in a limited information, like who can work with limited resources and take actions. So that sort of vision I had at that time. And I started with open courseware. There's an open courseware at MIT, and it has a fantastic list of courses. I started taking the course, studying myself, and the problem comes in, again, it's just theory. So how do I apply that? So I found some vendors, small shopkeepers near my houses. I just went to them, okay, and I start doing this, how are you doing consulting? We asked the problem, what sort of problem we have. So started asking those small problems of those shopkeepers, and I advising them using the same concept of learning, like SWOT analysis, or market demands. So all sort of thing for a small shopkeeper. Then I went to slightly bigger, like 2-3 shops in the city. And I was doing for free of cost. So nobody bothered what I'm doing. And I learned that this is fantastic way of learning. You are applying in a live scenario. So every day you could see the result of what you're suggesting. If they're using it, if they're using your suggestions, You can see the result. If they are not using, then also you can see. And if there is a need, there is a need of course correction, you can do it either. You can do it too. So that sort of thing. I did a one course that was business strategy, global business strategy. And then the MOOCs came in, the massive open online courses, the Coursera, edX, Stanford. And that was like a huge bonanza.
I remember that time, 100%.
Yes. And then they came and they were also experimental. They were experimenting this idea of online courses and community forums, assessments, and I jumped on it. And any kind of course I could find, I use them to study and applying those courses in a real life. And I design my own projects. How can I put that project into practice? For example, every company publishes annual reports, which is, it's available in public domain. And whenever the quarterly results are announced, there is always a discussion in business news, in business paper, newspaper. So what you can do, you just study that sector on your own, study the quarterly report, and read all the things you have to do. It's free of cost again. And try to apply the concept you have learned to see what sort of situation companies are in. If they are suggesting, if they are projecting, we are going to grow in this way, do you think it's a best way or not? And you can make a small report on yourself, and just switch on TV or read a newspaper and check the expert analysis. You can simply check. It's there. You can make comparison. Okay, am I good? am I thinking in the right direction or not? So it's one of the ways to stimulate your brain to think like a strategist. You can also think like an economist if you just understood supply chain theory or there is a Keynesian mechanism theory, and then you read newspaper and see, okay, why does Keynesian apply to it? How can I apply to this? And within if you keep doing it 2-3 weeks or for some case 2-3 months, you just become expert. You just read a newspaper and you know, what does it mean? A headlines simply gives you a complete indication of what this sector means. And it really helped me a lot to understand if something happens in one part of the world in this sector, what impact can it have in this country to me as an individual person? This kept on going, and I chosen the courses. And this really, these kind of projects I designed helped me a lot. And I used the help of discussion forums to connect with people. And one of the aspects, a campus gives you alumni connect, when you can meet people and interact. So I got active, and not just me, thousands of people who are taking courses. I became active, and we discussed various aspects about some industry in Kazakhstan, some farming thing in Peru and in Nigeria, all sorts of discussions we had. And it just gives a huge good perspective. All of it sitting at your home. You don't have to go anywhere. You are able to get perspective. You're applying the knowledge based on what you need. You don't have to do big fancy case studies to understand many things. If you want to do, that's fine, but this is also a way. So this is how I went on. And you're right, I didn't know that this will be successful. I just doing it for my own. And later on, I came in contact with a researcher who are doing work on online. And he said, wow, Ankit, you have designed something very innovative. Why don't we do something about it? So that's where all this, when I say that I became famous, that's how it came, because the inspiration from that researcher.
And Ankit, there's a couple of very interesting themes in what you've described to us. And I do want to touch about, you know, the point where this became known, where people started recognizing it. You started getting awards, you started getting recognition. But just before we go there, something really important that you said was what you were solving for, and I just wanted to check that with you, was something you were personally vested in. It was something that you were solving for yourself. It wasn't just a problem out there to solve for someone, an obscure, you know, figure. It was something that you could connect with. It was something that you saw the value of, you know, and you couldn't find a good answer to it. You couldn't find a good solution for it. So you started experimenting. And what then happened is you started connecting with people who, you know, in a broader sense, might not connect with you. You may have not connected the dots. They may have been kind of odd data points on your radar screen. But because you had a problem to solve, and because you were personally vested in it, you wanted to succeed, suddenly these things started to take on a meaning. Suddenly these connections you were making, whether it was through MIT, through, you know, other providers of open education, they started coming together. I guess my question would be, you know, when did you know that what you were developing had, let's call it in the technical term, had desirability, had a demand for by others, not just by you? You weren't just solving it for yourself or a few others around you, but this had a demand, a reach for much more broadly than that.
That's a good question. I remember there's one person, I cannot recall his name. He was equally invested like me. And I met him in a discussion forum, and he presented his work in MIT forum. There was a forum on online learning or something else, I can't recall it. And he presented his work, and I said, wow, okay, he is doing something similar. He was doing in, I think, literature or I think programming, I can't recall it clearly. And he presented his findings on how he went on taking so many courses, how he applied. And I realized, okay, he's solving what I'm doing. And I communicated with him. I approached him and I asked, okay. He said, wow, you have done something really serious, something really good, and people do like to have. Why don't you get in touch with somebody who approached me initially? So he was approached by MIT. He was approached by MIT OpenCourseWare to share his findings. Apparently, he was quite, allow me to call myself young, he was like 50s, 60s. So he was like reskilling himself, and he's approached by MIT staff to share his perspective. And he asked me to get in touch with them. So I got in touch with them, and they were like, wow, we never had some stories. And this is how it started. And I approached some of the researchers who are doing online who are doing research on online education, who are trying to make some of the modifications, especially the preventing cheating, how to engage for longer duration, what would be the ideal length of a video, how much length of a course should be. So these sort of questions they were trying to answer, and I collaborated with them. And they kept on referring me to others, and this is how the chain started. So initial was looking at this person's journey and approaching him, and he referring me to somebody else and other people. So this is how it started. Otherwise, I have never known that my work could have potential. I would have been happy that I have done it myself, applied it to my consulting work. And yeah, we wouldn't have been talking today. So.
Could I just ask a related question? And that's about roles and how fluid roles become when we develop new products and services. You know, whether we're trying to create education that's more inclusive, that's more personalized, that's more collaborative, whether we're trying to bring new technology into the education sector. Very often I find that what we used to call, you know, a persona, a target user of the solution, what we used to call a client, what we used to call someone, you know, a partner, a collaborator with us, those titles become quite fluid during the process. I mean, the way you were describing is people would reach out to you. And I suspect that it wasn't necessarily all that clear up front of whether this person would become a client, whether this person is collaborating in terms of IP, in terms of ways of working with you. There is that openness where we still are trying to figure out not just what the products or service would look like, but in fact, what role different people within the ecosystem would be playing. And that fluidity leads to, in our experience, more opportunity, where we don't box people in, where we allow ourselves to learn what role they could play best. And I'm saying this both in reference to individuals, or it could be to organizations who bring entire capabilities into the mix. So maybe just share with us a little bit, that as you started interacting with others, did you have a firm view or a clear view of what role they would be playing, or did it pan out somewhat differently, or was it just kind of fortuitous connections with people that you didn't know even existed and kind of you built it as, you know, what, as the saying goes, while the plane was flying?
Interesting question. I agree with some of the points you raised, and I try to talk, let me answer in today's context. The way EdTech sector and the way information is available easily to us, the role you're saying, the role you've known somebody within 2 years or within a year, it can be hugely different. He can be somebody else, and the person you are doing a job for 20 years, he can be somebody else, and he can help you for a totally entirely different reason. Coming up to your question, no, I did not have a firm view at the start of what it be, what it mean to me, an ecosystem, what help it can do. Because at the time, this entire online learning was very much looked at with skepticism. People were not ready to accept, was MI MOOCs were there. People were taking courses, but there was huge criticism. There was huge negativity around it that, yeah, it's not worth it. People are dropping out. Why university should even think of it? So yes, there was some skepticism, but there was this sort of excitement. There is some sort of disruption happening in the sector. So the people I met, they were looking at this sector, looking at in a disruptive way. Okay, whichever disruption they could find, whichever they think something new, something which can help to make education accessible to everybody, and especially the term used, personalized learning. I think that's what my project spoke. Customized and personalized learning. And that's what future of education is going to be. And anybody who can learn it at their own pace, at the comfort of their own time, at the comfort of their own home, no foundation, no restrictions. If you have four children, if you are like physically disabled, you cannot go back to university, then there is an option, there's an opportunity for you to reskill, to do something you may not able to do if you were there in the past system. So I built as I go along, as I went along. I wasn't even in EdTech sector at all. To remind you, I was just doing a project of my own. So this is how I went along. And the more I talked, the more I interacted with people from different places, different countries, and different organizations, the more I learned of the challenges they face, of the opportunities it makes. And when I presented this work at UNESCO, I was like, I met so many educationists across the world, and I was, wow, this could be the future of higher education, what you're suggesting. And that truly means that I did something. That was the day I realized, okay, I have done something which can be useful for others. And they helped a lot. They connected me with other people, and they even circulated my information. And they even came back to me to ask, this ideology you have done, can it be implemented across the world? If you think it can be, then why don't you circulate it? And this is how my work got translated to around 110 languages. I work with people, government, organizations, NGOs, everybody to spread this ideology. If I could do it at the sitting at comfort of my home, using not many things, it's very simple, in a practical way, you could do it too. So, well, to answer your question, no, I did not have a firm view. I built it along the way, though it helped, because I was trying to solve a problem which was not entirely mine. It was, I think, many people's, that they struggle to reskill, they struggle to find time to get back to universities, or the cost is too high. And there has been a latest trend that people started talking about ROI. If I pay this much amount of money to university, what do I get in return? And my project somehow did answer those questions, maybe in a management sector, but the ideology could be useful in many other sectors. So, yes.
Let's talk a little bit about the future of education. And it kind of feels a bit weird to talk about the future of education where you feel we're very much steeped in it. The past year and a half has certainly kind of accelerated many of the trends that we used to speak about when it comes to education, to the role of technology, to the changing requirements of education. So when we speak about what is now very much felt, not just spoken about or seen as the future of education, tell us a little bit about, with some hindsight, with the last year and a half in kind of already digested, already reflected on, how would you describe you know, the future of education. In I'm thinking particularly of education, not just at kind of at the tertiary or postgraduate level, but even earlier on. What are the kind of trends that are not only reinforcing, but that are getting us to think differently, more than just being pushed along one idea? So just from your perspective, when we speak about the future of education, what do you see?
That's a very interesting question. You have asked, when you talk about education, I think we also need to talk about various stakeholders in the education system. We have governments, we have teachers, we have even parents, and then there is an element of technology, hardware, many things. But to quote your question, I'd like to give you an example of the wonderful usage of EdTech technology. There is a startup based in Stockholm, and at the height of pandemic, they designed a system, they designed an AI-based curriculum to train nurses in United States, one of the cities in United States. And what they did is they accelerate the training of those nurses so that they can be deployed when situation arises at the height of COVID. And this is a wonderful example on how we shifted from physical to virtual at the time of when it's needed. And coming back to question of future of higher education. So as I said, this example, we have not just education, we have a skill development and associated factors. Technology is going to play a huge role, number one. That's right. The trend in technology is how we can localize or customize as per the need of the user. Let's say I'm in India, we have 22 official languages. And so far, majority of content I've seen, the startups I've seen across the world are in English language. They have to customize to local needs. Maybe the same subject, the way they teach could be different from, let's say, Finland to India. And that's the future is going to be, that we'll see more customization, more localization in vernacular languages. That's one aspect. Second, the role of teachers. So far, the role of teacher wasn't discussed, but we do need supervision, especially at earlier levels, it's in tertiary levels. Because when you talk about online education, which is what is there at most of the time, it requires certain encouragement for individual, whether it's a child or adult or a company employee, to take initiative, to log in on time, to finish those videos, to finish those assessment. And at school level, the role of teacher become important. Technology can act as a helping tool, helping hand, but it's teacher who has to see whether the child is progressing or not, what sort of encouragement it needs. And we have to see how this role of teacher can be modified so that they will not feel threatened that their jobs will be taken away or their role will be diminished. So this is one of the aspects we have to see. And the third, in education, when we talk about courses, we need to talk about assessment. This is the contagious issue all along. How will you assess? How will you assess the quality of the person who you just trained? You can easily assess somebody in programming language. You just give the program, he will type, he will do something, and you will let you know. But if we go beyond programming, how will you identify, how will you build a questionnaire or assessment or assignment that will give him the ability to apply all the concepts, and it will give you a confidence, okay, he has learned what he learned himself in virtual way, what he was doing in classroom way. So that's where it's going to be. And fourth is standardization. You're right. A lot of thoughts were diminished last year. The barriers were broken, but also the rise of so much information, so many courses, and we lacked certain level of standardization or certain standards on measuring the quality. There was a time a few years ago when uploading a video was sufficient. It's not today. You have to have an interacting platform. You have to have something at community level, and people should recognize the certificates you are providing. Otherwise, what's the use? The same certificate person can get to somewhere else. There are so many, and he can go back to university. So that's where the providers have to differentiate themselves. And we have to think about the inequality induced due to tech penetration, especially the broadband connectivity. I witnessed it myself. those who had laptops could access everything. Those who did not, they were left out in all 1.5 years. So going beyond, these challenges have to be there. But the future looks bright. The future will be more customized. Any individual who is a slow learner can do it at his own pace. He doesn't have to sit with 60 people in the classroom where everyone else could learn quickly and he was left out. So online learning provides some sort of alternative to this. And look at the working mothers. We are talking about flexible working environment or work from home. Those mothers don't have to leave their children. They can do it at their own pace. That's the beauty of online education. You can do it at your own pace. You can rewind the video 10 times unless you understand. And if you don't understand, you can ask 10 questions, 15 times. And there is somebody in a discussion forum, maybe your classmate, who can answer you, and you can do it easily. And this is something online education can really help to teach or to train, to make people skilled in remote areas where it's difficult to convince teachers to go. It's the problem I have seen, that teachers don't want to go beyond city boundaries. And so this can be act as alternative. And when you talk about 100% literacy, this could be one of the ways to act. And the way online education is streamlined, it's very agile. You can always modify. So this can also help the industries in the way technology is changing every day. This can also help industries to retrain their employees at a quick pace. And these are a few of the trends I have seen. The challenges I saw, which I think I already mentioned, is that we have some inbuilt biases, especially majority of courses, or what I've seen so far, are like one-sided or designed for masses. So you have some clear idea of designing curriculum for 60, 100 people. You don't know the individual needs, who is a slow learner, who is a fast learner. And I think going in the future, this will be the challenge they have to tackle. How the course can automatically slow down for a slower person or a slower learners, and how it can be paced up for someone who is very quick in grasping the fact.
And Kit, maybe before you move on, I think you raised a really important point here, and you spoke about it in the context of customization, that you know, you speak about the fallacy of the one or the perfect solution. You know, we often as human beings fall into this fallacy. You know, we do a lot of work around climate change and energy transition, and there's this this kind of fallacy that if we just get one solution right, then everything else falls into place. Then the problem goes away. And we find these are complex systems, and education is no less complex. You know, so for example, providing connectivity for schools, for communities to be able to draw on content and on teachers elsewhere, that's great. And that's an important part of a solution. It's an enabler. But from everything you're describing, there is no one perfect solution. We really, you know, it's a rich landscape within which we can go and innovate, where it's a rich landscape where we can choose on who is our primary customer, who would benefit the most. Are we focusing on solving a problem primarily for the teacher, for the school management, for the pupils, for the parent, perhaps funder or the sponsor of the pupil? That's what makes the education sector for me so exciting, is because we don't have this fallacy. We can't just fall into, here's one solution, it would work. You know, let's provide tablets for all students, and suddenly the level of education increases. We've seen many studies around this that actually we're just kind of touching the surface of how complex the system is. And therefore, we need more systemic and richer solutions, which really draws on our deep understanding of the customer that we're solving a problem for. That's essentially what you're describing, isn't it?
Yes. I'll give you a simple example to that. You can have a math tutorial for sixth standard. Let's say you upload videos the way you teach in classroom. And there is one startup I met, I think, a few months ago. They are making math learning interesting by using home-based example, like standing on stairs or using stairs, or using your clothes, how you count, how you subtract, how you divide. And they are giving you so much personal touch. And even if you give the tablet, and don't go beyond giving a tablet, it's all the same again. Maybe few students will get access to information. They don't have to come to classroom. But we did not make it inclusive. We did not make it a objective. We still are not able to solve the real issue, which was to make learning inclusive, exciting, in a way that it helps anybody who's accessing it. So you are right. It's had many layers. It has a lot of roles to play. And there are many stakeholders, simply because education in many countries is considered the right. It's a right to have education. So there is a role of government, and there's a role of public sector, public schools, and there's a role of making policies at higher level. There's a role of how much investment is needed. Are they willing to do it or not? Who will make the decisions? So there are plenty of things coming into play. And that's what I said. You're right, and I agree to it, that we have just scratched the surface. A lot to be done, and a lot of experimentation is going on in terms of challenges I highlighted, because this sector is very much disorganized. It's you have a startup, you are solving problems of tennis school. You're also a startup, you're solving, but your solution may not work beyond those tennis schools. So how will you grow? How will you do it? And you can be a startup which is working fabulously in one country, same solution. But if you go beyond that, maybe it doesn't work, simply because the government is not ready to invest money in buying new equipments or buying computers. So they ask you to subsidize or some other issues to come up. So yes. Yeah, I agree. This is a lot of exciting. This is an exciting sector. It has own challenges. It has own opportunities. And people are trying to find innovative solutions. So this is really something to watch in the next 5-10 years.
Keith, maybe with that, just to, move on to my final question, which is, you know, looking at the education sector from an investor perspective, you know, if we look at the numbers, the you know, the investments that are being made in edtech over the past year have been staggering. They've been growing consistently over the last decade, but 2020 and the early indications for 2021, the figures we've got to date, are significantly above. Whether what we're looking, and I'm looking specifically at the investments in Asia, but if you look even at other regions of the world, a very similar trend. So certainly a hot industry, both for providers of new products and services, for incumbents, and for investors. And I want to just turn the table for a moment and look at the sector from an investor perspective. What makes the sector exciting, and what are the kind of insights that you can share with those who are considering investing in the education tech space?
That's a wonderful question. Very good question. And I agree. The last 1.5 year was largely driven by hype. It just COVID came and everybody has to shift online. And anybody who had certain solution, they just got huge traction, huge. And the investors jumped in. But going in future, we have to be more rational about it. We have to really think whether this is going to solve any problems. So I can give you 3-4 points. First of all, what sort of target audience you are going to aim, or any company who's trying to solve a problem. There is a K-12, like children's, then there is a school, then education, then higher education, and then there's a corporate level. And I believe the corporate level is something which is going to see a huge traction, simply because it's not government controlled. Higher education, school, even primary level, there's a huge involvement of government, and it will take some time, and competition could be high, and the scale requires too much. So corporate level and reskilling, especially middle-aged people who want to change their career, can see a huge amount of traction and a lot of experimentation. So this is one target audience you have to in mind. Second is, what is the long-term plan of the startup? What sort of problem they are trying to solve, and how they're going to solve it? Is it a long-term solution, not just COVID-induced solution? It's true that people want online solution. Many corporates want online solution. But do they need it after pandemic is over? Do they need it or not? Or are your startup going to work with the companies who are going to provide work from home or flexible policies or not? So these things you have to look at. Who are the clients they are going to serve, and what sort of solution they are going to provide? And you have to also look at the geographies and the cities, or the kind of customer they're going to serve. In my experience, I've seen some industries, especially IT and recently the medtech, is on med tech, and I think clean tech. So these are all ed tech actually. Anything which is educational and skill development is ed tech. But there is a trend coming on med tech and clean tech and information technology to train those employees or those people in those sectors. And these are growing sectors. They are going to grow as we go more virtual and we utilize the technology in our daily lives. So your investor can look at it, what exactly the sector they are serving. It's not just, it's ed tech, specific ed tech, like focusing on pharma tech or health tech, or if you are, this one startup I learned is more agri tech. So they are trying to digitize the one of the markets, how they the farmers can sell. This is exciting. This is still ed tech because they have to teach farmers. They will collect some money and they have to teach farmers, and they also have to teach the warehouse people. So it's still a skill development ed tech, but in different sense. So this non-traditional way of skill developments are going to play. And fourth, you have to understand how much technology is there. And that by that, I mean, if a startup is going to use high bandwidth, high expensive laptop, if their solutions are required somebody to have like 8 GB RAM laptop or high bandwidth connectivity, then it has a limitations. It can only work in areas where these technology or these solutions are, these equipments are available.
Yes.
If you are looking at startup which has mobile too, which can work in low internet penetration areas or low speed, it's wonderful because it can work at all, work everywhere. So these four things you have to look. There can be many other points, but I can recall only those four at the moment.
No, this is fantastic. Great insights. And Kit, this is a great conversation. We can continue for another hour easily and delve even deeper into the education sector. I'm really glad you've added the adult education, the things that we don't necessarily look at education, but are that, or that have a component of it, whether in agri, whether in industry, whether in new sectors that are being formed. So I just want to say thank you. It's a great conversation. I'm sure we'll have you back at our studio at some point, and I'd love for our audiences to continue the conversation. Thanks again. And for all those listening, thank you for being part of Hidden Growth Champions.
Thank you very much, Sahar, for having me here and giving me opportunity to share my perspectives. And I hope it will help somebody. And in the future, anybody wants to connect with me and have more deeper questions, I'm always available on LinkedIn to have a chat.
Fantastic. Thank you, Anki.
Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.